This is Tax Update for Saturday, April the 8th, 2006. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying on the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of this document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This week's podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Visit their website for information on subscribing to their various email newsletters of interest to tax practitioners and archives of useful information. This week, as we come down to the end of our tax season, we will consider the case of Benson v. Commissioner, Tax Court Memo 2006-55, where the tax court considered an interesting issue, that is, the application of the adequate disclosure provisions in order to avoid the 6-year statutes for substantial understatements of income under Section 6501(e)(1)(a). This case is an interesting analysis of what needs to be done in order to prevent that 6-year statute from being applied, as well as an interesting discussion of what does not apply in meeting that standard. Now, the case was being reconsidered by the tax court, which had previously ruled against the taxpayers on the merits of the tax itself. See the case of Benson v. Commissioner, TC Memo 2004-272. In that case, however, the court had ruled the IRS had not shown fraud, at least not to a sufficient extent to have the court say that the open statute provision applied. So the court sent back the case essentially for recomputation to determine whether the 6-year statute was going to apply due to a 25% understatement. The taxpayers came back and argued later that, in fact, that they had not been able to argue they had adequately disclosed on the return, and that that had not been presented essentially during the case because of various items. The court noted that after our opinion at TC Memo 2004-272, petitioners filed a motion for reconsideration. Petitioners now for the first time argue that the prior opinion did not provide a basis to resolve the question of whether the petitioners, Burton O. and Elizabeth E. Benson, the Bensons, disclosed the understatement of gross income on their returns. Petitioners argue their failure to make this argument before our previous opinion was due to the complexities of the way the case was presented and briefed. On March 10, 2005, we granted petitioners' motion for reconsideration of findings and opinion pursuant to Rule 161 with respect to the application of 6501E. So the question at hand was, did the taxpayers adequately disclose the positions on the return? Why is that important? Well, let's take a look at Section 6501(e)(1), uppercase A, which gives us the general rule for the 6-year statute. That provision provides, if the taxpayer omits from gross income an amount properly includable therein, which is in excess of 25% of the amount of gross income stated in the return, the tax may be assessed or a proceeding in court for the collection of such tax may be begun without assessment at any time within 6 years after the return is filed. So the question becomes, did we trigger that? For purposes of this paragraph, in the case of a trade or business, the term gross income means the total of the amounts received or accrued from the sale of goods or services, if such amounts were required to be shown on the return prior to diminution by the cost of such sales or services, and 6501(e)(1)(a)(i), which is the key question here, in determining the amount omitted from gross income, there shall not be taken into account any amount which is omitted from gross income stated in the return, if such amount is disclosed in the return or in a statement attached to the return, in a manner adequate to apprise the secretary of the nature and amount of such item. Obviously, the question becomes, what triggers the second case? In essence, when do we have adequate disclosure? Because otherwise, the 25% test is mechanical, and we have a mechanical 6-year statute. Meaning, from a practical standpoint, if the IRS is examining a return, which normally would be within the normal 3-year statute, but the agent uncovers an understatement of gross income issue, and that understatement appears to trigger the 25% rule, appears pretty clearly it's going to trigger that, The agent can then go back and get all 6 years running, so that we can have a much larger assessment than we normally would. So the adequate disclosure provisions become important. Now, let's take a look at the Benson case. First thing to consider is, why do we have this provision in the first place? Well, the point of this provision is that taxpayers are generally in a better position to know what's going on than will the IRS be. Well, that makes sense. And those of us who are trained in auditing understand one simple point. One of the most difficult things to do when you're looking at financial auditing is to deal with items that should be reported on the record or in the books, but aren't. The same problem arises for a return. It is easy enough to look at those items that are reported and discover, are they reported correctly? Is the right amount shown? You know, did those things happen? Did those deductions occur? Is that the amount of income? You know, did that income happen? Those are all easy to tie down because you know they're there. In the case of items that simply aren't reported, that is an infinite universe of transactions out there, and you're looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack. Taxpayers who try to take advantage of that fact by leaving all clues to the item off their return, the court is holding, or the Congress held, I should say, should not be allowed to benefit from that by letting the 3-year statute go away. Since the problem is much more difficult for the IRS to solve, to find that unreported income, the Congress has allowed them basically twice the time to do the job. And that is what's going on with this provision. The tax court explains the provision in the Benson case, setting up their opinion. The tax court notes, the purpose of extending the period of limitation under 6501E is to level the playing field when the taxpayer's omissions of income places the commissioner at a disadvantage in discovering errors. Interpreting a prior version of Section 6501E, the Supreme Court stated that Congress extended the period of limitations to allow the commissioner additional time to investigate tax returning cases where, because of a taxpayer's omission to report some taxable item, the commissioner is at a special disadvantage in detecting errors. In such instances, a return on its face provides no clue to the existence of the omitted item. The court goes on to explain, to adequately appraise the commissioner, the statement must be sufficiently detailed to alert the commissioner and his agents as to the nature of the transaction so the decision as to whether to select the return for audit may be a reasonably informed one. While a taxpayer disclosure must be more substantial than supplying the commissioner with a clue which would be sufficient to intrigue a Sherlock Holmes, the disclosure need not recite every underlying fact. Although a misleading statement may provide a clue to omitted gross income, it does not adequately apprise the commissioner of the nature and amount of an item. So that outlines the basic construct we're going to look for and the way we're going to have to look at our disclosures to determine if we meet these rules. Now, the court goes on to note the disclosure can include a reference to other returns. As the court note, when a taxpayer's individual return contains references to other documents or return, those references provide a clue or serve as notice to the commissioner. Specifically, when a return includes a reference to a partnership return, partnership returns are considered together with individual returns to determine the amount omitted from gross income. Similarly, when taxpayers' return include a reference to an S corporation, the corporate information return on Form 1120S must be considered along with the taxpayer's individual return in resolving the issue of adequate disclosure. So essentially, we can take a look at pass-through returns. We have told the commissioner we are using information from this pass-through entity. The commissioner has been apprised that the commissioner should look at that pass-through return in order to make a judgment about what to do with the taxpayer's return. Now, for the Bensons, one particular problem was one of the returns in question here, a related return, was a C corporation return, not a return that would have flowed to their personal return. The Bensons were arguing, since the issue at hand was, in their view, a reallocation among their related entities, the corporate return disclosure should give them protection. So if they gave adequate disclosure on the C corporation return, that should protect their personal return. The court disagreed with that assessment, noting neither Section 6501E1AII nor the case law interpreting that section requires the respondent to examine the corporate returns of ERG, that was their C corporation, in search of clues that disclose income. The Bensons have not cited any authority to support their contention that the returns of a taxable subchapter C corporation serve as an adjunct to an individual taxpayer's return for purposes of Section 6501(e)(1)(a)(ii). Instead, the Bensons rely on Benderhoff v. United States and Roshuni v. Commissioner, which involve the returns of Subchapter S corporations. This court has explained that the returns of Subchapter S corporations and partnerships should be examined in conjunction with the individual returns because those entities are pass-through entities. See Harlan v. Commissioner and Roshuni v. Commissioner. As a Subchapter C corporation, ERG is a taxable entity. It does not have the pass-through aspects of an S corporation, and it files income tax returns, not information returns. Therefore, the rationale for treating the returns of the pass-through entities as adjuncts to an individual return is not present in the case of a Subchapter C corporation income tax return. Respondent was not required to examine the returns of ERG, a Subchapter C corporation, to determine whether the Bensons disclosed items of gross income. A key factor in this case is that the issue became, were there constructive dividends from ERG, their C corporation, to the Bensons? And those constructive dividends dealt with items of income that were being reallocated among related entities. The court noted that in this case, the commissioner was under no obligation to go grab the C corporation return to determine that maybe if games were being played there and there were items that should have been reported on the shareholders' return. This is a significant issue when we are dealing with the case of shifting income among related entities. It's important to note in the Benson's case, it appeared that magically the C Corporation got to a $75,000 income level every year. Now, those of you who remember your rates will quickly understand why the C Corporation might have wanted $75,000 of income, no more, no less. That's a very nice sweet spot for to bring a C corporation in where you can get relatively low tax rates, especially if you're needing to accumulate income. If you go above that level, you're going to end up triggering higher levels of tax, which you probably don't want. If you go below that level and income is essentially at that point flowing to the shareholders, you may find that you're paying a higher marginal rate on the shareholders' returns. And if you're needing to accumulate funds in the corporation, maybe that's not such a wonderful deal. So obviously the $75,000 was a sweet spot that they were hitting with all of these machinations. Now note, there were large numbers moving around here, and the $75,000 was the magic number at the end. Now, another important factor to note that we need to understand as those of us preparing returns, especially in a situation that we're facing right now, we're within a week of the deadline. Amended returns do not count to stop the statute here. If the disclosure on the original return is not adequate, the six-year statute applies even if you later amend the return to make adequate disclosures. The court notes, in Section 6501(e)(1)(a), the word return does not include amended return. The court cites two cases in support of this. The period of limitation starts to run with the filing of the original return, and the filing of an amended return does not affect the period of limitations. Here's the key for the Bensons. In their case, they had amended an S corporation return. Well, we just solved the problem that we had in the first issue here. This wasn't a C return. This is a return we can look through and find. And they claimed the amended return had adequate disclosure. Now, the court went on to state, sorry, we don't buy that. As the court noted, amended return do not correct the omission of income from an original return. Basically, the section requires the IRS to examine only the original returns and original returns of the pass-through entities listed on their returns. Any clues to omitted gross income on the amended returns of NPI, that was their S corporation, will not prevent the six-year period of limitations of Section 6501(e) from applying to the Bensons' 1989, 1990, 1993, and 1994 tax years. Now, this is a crucial issue at this point. As noted, we all have clients who don't want to go on extension and who want to get the returns filed by April 15th or want them by whatever the deadline may be. If that return does not have adequate disclosures, if there's a complex issue and the question of disclosure under 6501E is to be considered, what you do on the original return that you will file basically a week from now will be crucial to determine whether or not you met the test. You can't go back and fix this one later. It may be very crucial, therefore, to understand that in the rush to complete returns, if you have a potential omission of income issue, if you have a case where the service could argue for an omission of income, you may very well decide that this is not a smart idea to rush the return out the door before April 15th. Maybe this is one to put on extension so that the original return filed can be carefully considered rather than a rush disclosure stuck on or a rush lack of disclosure stuck on. Continuing with the Bensons, a disclosure that is misleading will not be sufficient to apprise the IRS of the existence of an issue. And this was a problem in the Bensons case with disclosures of many of the related party transactions. In the area of related party royalties, the court noted, we find disclosure of royalties on NPI's returns were misleading. The returns of NPI failed to disclose it received royalties from a related corporation, ERG, the C Corporation, or that Burton Benson acted on behalf of both corporations involved in that transaction. In essence, he was the buyer and the seller. The returns of NPI failed to disclose that ERG sold the patent rights to NPI and simultaneously licensed those rights back from NPI in the exclusive licensing agreement. Also, the royalty label listed on the returns of NPI was misleading and inadequate to apprise respondents that the transactions constituted a tax planning tool completely lacking in economic substance. Because the royalty disclosures in the return of NPI were misleading, they failed to satisfy Section 6501E1AII. This was a case where they were using these royalty payments to help manage the income. In essence, that was shifting income from the C Corporation back to the S Corporation and then out into Mr. Benson's pocket. So essentially, it would pass through. It would not be taxed at the C Corporation level because we had a deduction. It would go to the S Corporation. Yes, Mr. Benson would pay tax there, but Mr. Benson would only pay the single level of tax at the S Corporation level. There would not be the double tax, one at the corporate level and one at the individual level. The court goes on to discuss payments for engineering services, another shifting issue. Similarly, the bench argued that NPI returns disclose engineering services paid by ERG to NPI. Apparently, the royalties weren't enough to get us to $75,000. We had to have engineering as well. ERG transferred millions of dollars to NPI for payments of supposed engineering services. However, there is no evidence of what services Burton performed on behalf of NPI other than his testimony that he provided ERG with engineering know-how. No third party testified as to what Burton specifically did. There is no evidence of how much time he devoted to this endeavor and whether the amounts charged were reasonable and customary. In fact, we infer from the evidence that in conjunction with the exclusive licensing agreement, the label engineering services created to achieve Burton's goal of having ERG show a consistent paper profit of $75,000. Court noted that number was kind of sitting there. After reviewing the NPI returns, we find that these returns lack any specific reference to engineering services. Additionally, like the royalties that NPI purportedly received from ERG, we find that the characterization of ERG transfers to NPI as payments for engineering services was misleading. Burton Benson called ERG to make these transfers to NPI for the purpose of maintaining ERG's profits at $75,000. He used the term engineering services explanation to justify those payments. We find that this label does not reflect the true nature of the transfers. For purposes of Section 6501E1AII, we hold that the NPI returns failed to adequately disclose the nature and amounts of these transfers. Therefore, we had a management tool here to manage income, and we were shifting income around, and we called them and put nice little labels on the return that said they were engineering services and royalties. The taxpayers attempted to argue that was sufficient to apprise the IRS of the existence of an issue. The court noted that that was not sufficient. The labels weren't there. Finally, we had a little issue with a rental. Now, there's no question that property was rented. The problem was that it turns out that rent payments in excess, that the C Corporation made rent payments in excess of the amount it was legally obligated to make. Apparently, we were kind of spreading around our shifting, our income shifting mechanism, so we had a bunch of things involved. The court noted, we find that the low rent payment constituted constructive dividends to the Bensons because ERG made payments it had no contractual obligation to make. We further found the payment of rent by an ERG constituted constructive dividends to the Bensons. The returns of NPI do not provide any clues that suggest that ERG's payments for the Lowell plant exceeded ERG's legal obligation to make those payments. The disclosures do not adequately reveal the nature of these transfers. Therefore, we hold that the Bensons failed to disclose the constructive dividends received in the form of purported rent payments for the Lowell plant. While the returns of NPI disclose receipt of rent for the Stanford plant, these disclosures were misleading because they did not inform the respondent that the payments exceeded ERG's contractual rent obligation. In Benson versus Commissioner, we stated the maximum monthly lease amount listed in the unbundling agreement apparently reflected the product of an arm's-length negotiation between the two warring brothers. Under these circumstances, this is the best indication of the intent of the parties and the value of the use of the property at that time. The court goes on to note, the actual payments exceeded the monthly lease payments as agreed upon the unbundling agreement. We think that the disclosure of rental payments is misleading because an examiner would expect these payments reflected the monthly payments agreed to during the arm's length negotiation. Nothing in the returns of NPI informed respondent that NPI received rent payments from ERG that exceeded the amounts the parties agreed upon the unbundling agreement. We hold the Bensons did not adequately appraise respondent of the nature of these transactions for purposes of Section 6501(e)(1)(a)(ii). So the Bensons lost out on adequate disclosure. Now the case goes on to discuss the mechanics of computing the 25% test. We won't go into that here. For those issues, you can go ahead and read the case. We do want to consider some of the practical aspects of the disclosure question here. Tax practitioners who are involved in preparation of returns, as noted, we have one shot to get this right. That is on the original return. If it is not on the original return, the disclosure will not be adequate. You will have a 6-year statute if the mechanics get us to a 25% understatement. As noted, that is potentially dangerous, and particularly dangerous this time of year when there is a rush to get things done and certain taxpayers are impatient and believe that, well, we absolutely don't want to go on extension because that automatically increases the chance of being examined. Therefore, we're going to have an issue when we go forward and try to handle these matters with these taxpayers. As well, clients are normally reluctant to lay out a path for an IRS agent on how to challenge their return, and that's what you're being asked to do when you make these adequate disclosures. The problem is we have a trade-off here. There is no question that an item that is not disclosed is more difficult to uncover on the return. There is no question that there are many cases where we have items that reasonably it's not clear whether they will or will not be includable in income, whether there is or is not a position for the service to take. The service may have a reasonable basis for challenging a position. The taxpayer may similarly have a reasonable basis for taking it. The issue becomes, having not told the service about this position, if in fact you lose the issue down the line, you would have a 6-year statute. However, if you tell them about the issue, you may discover taxpayer prevails, but you have now incurred significant expense fighting this issue because you laid out for the service a basic attack and said, please come get us on this issue. Here comes our issue as making the choice as to whether to disclose or not disclose. As noted, if we have the 6-year statute, things can get expensive quickly. And the most likely trigger is going to be during an exam that takes it back into the 6 years, that during the exam that uncovers an issue. Clearly, it's an issue that's going to be one of potential omitted income. Now we can open the 6-year statute. The key issue is that taxpayers need to be the one to make this decision, not the practitioner. The practitioner needs to advise the client. But the practitioner needs to watch being put in the position of being able to guarantee what's going to happen. Guaranteeing is a little bit difficult to do. You appraise clients that there is a relevant challenge for this position. You appraise taxpayers that the IRS could reasonably challenge it. that while we believe the position maybe is supportable and even more likely than not, though we'll ignore that for the circular 230 problem that may create, but even if we believe it's more likely than not, it's still possible for the service to challenge the position. And it is possible, even if not likely, that they may win it. And if they won it, the mechanics would get us into a six-year statute. Now the question becomes, do you want to disclose? The answer to that question makes a difference as to whether we're going to have a six-year or three-year statute. Secondly, if you decide to disclose, you need to make it clear to the client that this can't be a halfway disclosure. If it appears you're leaving relevant material out of the disclosure, you probably don't have a disclosure. Important items that need to be in the disclosure is the existence of related parties or relationships that would impact the question of whether the transaction is what's stated. It is important to adequately describe the transactions in full detail and to indicate perhaps why there would be a challenge issue potentially out there viewed from the IRS's perspective. But as well, note to the client that putting that in there does mean that if we're examined and if the agent reads the disclosure, that may very well become the path that they're going to take to challenge. As well, the original Benson case is a very useful outline of the danger of using multiple entities to manage or shift income. What we found in Benson was that the entities involved were shifting income from one party to another, and we had this C corporation to magically get $75,000 of income every year. As was noted in Benson, this may create some problems as six-year statutes may be triggered. In Benson's case, the problem was the constructive dividends that were being claimed inside of all this moving funds around and the fact that the C corporation did not count for purposes. We weren't able to aggregate everything. We had to look at the Benson's return standing alone, and that caused the six-year statute to apply and the problems to start happening. We had to break these returns apart. We couldn't consider them as one whole. This is a very real issue because taxpayers seem to love to do this type of balancing routine. Be very careful and take a look at these issues. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, April 8, 2006.